Just a quick note, last episode we started a three-part series with Jason Caldwell. If you haven't already listened to part one before you get into today's episode, I highly recommend that you do. All right, so as leaders, we turn to books, podcasts, and conferences to learn, to grow, to prepare ourselves for each season. And these are without a doubt valuable. But no matter how much we prepare, no matter how prepared we think we are, or no matter how bulletproof we believe our plan to be for any season, conflict isn't inevitable. Adversity will come, and failures are going to happen. Struggle, adversity, and failure, they're always going to be our greatest teachers if we are willing to reflect, listen, and learn from these experiences. Jason Caldwell is a leader who is willing to put his ego aside to learn from better leaders around him and learn from the failures of his teams. Today, we'll learn about two of his most profound leadership experiences, rowing for Vesper Rowing Club, one of the best rowing clubs in the world, where he felt completely out of place, totally inadequate. And secondly, we're going to talk about his first Atlantic crossing, which was without a doubt a hugely humbling experience for Jason. So welcome back to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nerman, and I am joined by my friend and co-host Nate Sanderson. I'm the founder of TOC Culture Consulting, coaching and supporting coaches to become better leaders and build better cultures in a practical and simple way. I'd like to think that this podcast is one of the best podcasts in the world on transformational coaching, but you know what else is also pretty darn good? A book called The Culture System, A Proven Process for Creating an Extraordinary Team Culture. If you haven't heard of it, it's by me. It's my latest book, and I haven't met someone who hasn't found a lot of value in it yet. So check it out at myculturesystem.com. It's an easy and engaging read, but it's also super practical. It will give you the tools and methods necessary to build a great team culture and the system to help you implement those tools and methods. Lots of links for wherever you are in the world are at myculturesystem.com. Now let's get into part two of our conversation with Jason Caldwell.
Well, you've got us to Vesper, and that's one of the chapters that I really wanted to dig into a little bit. So maybe start with this. You get the opportunity. You mentioned you weren't the biggest guy. I enjoyed the anecdote in the book where you talked about, you know, you had this great 7-minute erg score and you're all excited to get on the machine. And then you find out you're going to row for 80 minutes instead of 7 minutes, you know, and it seems like you keep having these oh shit moments when you make a commitment and then you're like, oh, I didn't realize that that's what I signed up for necessarily. But there's a transformation that you talk about in the book and you mentioned in other interviews between your first year at Sonoma State. You go on train with Vesper, you decide to come back to Sonoma State, and there's a seed kind of that it seems to be sort of the genesis for this leadership approach that is different in you after that first summer at Vesper. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about kind of that transformation.
Yeah, I've got a great story for that. And you know, I'm on this team, and the coach of Vesper is a Dutch guy, McKeel. He's won three Olympic medals and three separate Olympics. He's the most decorated Dutch rower ever in the history of their country. And by moving to the United States and taking his head coaching job, becomes the most decorated rower in the United States. And I have no business being on this team. Let's be very clear about that. Like, it's Yale, it's Dartmouth, it's Harvard, it's Princeton, and then it's Sonoma State. And so I show up there and I'm just thinking, like, this is gonna be a fun 1 week story I'm gonna have to go back and tell all my buddies about back home, you know. But he keeps me on the team the entire summer. And again, I'm barely hanging on by a thread, practice twice a day. But one of the things I'm doing a lot of observing. I have no thoughts of ever being on this team on a regular basis, certainly not making their year round program. One of the things I observe is this guy named Don, and Don comes from Dartmouth, which is a great rowing school by any standards, but on the Ivy League scale, they're in the bottom third, which is still great, by the way. But and the thing about Don is he's also not one of the biggest guys. His erg score is much better than mine, but not the best on the team. But he rows the stroke seat, which is the 8th seat of the top boat at Vesper. That's pick your sport. That is the leader of any team. You know, that's the quarterback. That's the point guard bringing up the ball. You know, whatever it is, that's what he is. And The reason he's there is because when we seat race, which is a complicated thing, I'll just tell you, is a way for people to find out who's faster on the water. He never loses. He wins every seat race. And again, I'm interested because this guy has no business winning seat races against a guy who's 6'8 from Princeton, but he does. He beats them all. And, you know, I'm finally get some courage to ask him how he does it. He's kind of coy with it, and maybe he doesn't know it exactly, but he just, you know, has kind of does this kind of like just observe, like, we're seat racing tomorrow, watch what I do kind of thing. I was like, all right, I'll do it. So he comes into my boat after we do the first shot. He comes in, he just turns around with the guy, says, all right, give everything to me right now. I want it all, you know. And he just kind of like give him like just one or two little sentences. And I was in a boat without him just, you know, 15 minutes before. Now he moved in. I can feel the boat like surging. I'm like, this boat is moving right now. And of course he wins, you know. And I'm like, that couldn't have been him. And so he kind of tells me that he never actually rows that hard during the seat races. He just sets the boat up or balances the boat really well and allows the seven other guys to win the race for him. And he said he did that because he says, I just earned their respect before. Like, I'm always here to help the guy out, you know, do an extra row with them or something like that. But he was, as they say, he was a man of the people. You know, he was. Everybody loved him on that team. He was social. He was, you know, jovial. He was he would disarm arguments between two teammates. He'd be that guy that would go in there. You know, he's the Nobel Peace Prize winner of the team. And when he got into your boat, no matter who you were, you kind of felt like you owed him something. And that was a lesson I learned. This guy, just like me, I had no business being on the team. He had no business being that fast, but he was, because everybody wanted to row harder when he was in the boat. And that was a big lesson for me, because when I internalized that, looking back at Sonoma State, even though we had a successful first year, I led with the stick, not with the carrot type of stuff. You know, I people were afraid of me. You know, people were intimidated by me. If Jason thought that you weren't working as hard as he was, you know, you were going to hear from him. And it wasn't going to be pretty, and he was going to make you feel bad about yourself. That's how I led, and that's all I knew. And so, at the end of that summer, McKeel, the head coach, said, because I had just graduated from Sonoma State, he said, "I'll get you into Penn, by the way, which is an Ivy League school in Philadelphia, and their boathouse is right next door." He's like, "You know, you'll be on their team, and I'll be able to keep an eye on you, and we can do some extra workouts and stuff like that." I mean, great offer, by the way, you know, to do grad work at Penn. Didn't know how I was going to afford it, but I mean, whatever. That was awesome. But I decided to go back to Sonoma State. I actually, I applied as a grad student in geology at Sonoma State, because it was like rolling admission. So I was able to last minute do that. But the reason for that was I felt like I owed the team something, you know, and I wanted to make it up to them. I love those guys. I owed them everything. I owed that coach everything. And I wanted to. And I remember coming back. The team was happy to have me back, but I was a different person. I have a book. I still have it, a journal. Every day I did my observations from people on the team and the workouts that we did. And I handed it to Mike on the first day back. I said, read this. This is what we have to start doing as a team. And then I started just leading different.
I think that's such a fascinating journey. And I want to ask a question about this from the book as well, because when I first heard you tell the story about Don, I think it was on the Rich Roll podcast, and you know, you had mentioned how it felt like, or this was my impression, that he was like everybody's best friend. You know, you got yourself in trouble at the bar, needed a ride home, Don was the guy. You needed extra time on the water, Don was the guy. You know, and so there's a certain aspect of that being a teammate off the water impacted his ability to lead people on the water. But in the book, you also talk a little bit about the importance of authenticity in effort. And I wonder if you could explain that a little bit more, because I was watching the Tom Brady documentary on ESPN Plus. I don't know if you've seen this Man in the Arena. He's talking about his second ring. And at the end of that season, he says, you know, we pulled for each other and we believed in each other because, you know, we cared about each other on and off the field. And at the time, that really echoed with what you were saying before. And then when I got into the book, like, but there's something more to it, that the effort is almost a currency to building that trust. And I wonder if you could just sort of expound on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, all this stuff is meaningless if it's not authentic, if you don't genuinely mean it. One of the things about Don that I liked so much and gravitated toward him. And I was a victim of his charisma as well. I don't know if victim is the right word, but I fell right into it. He was such a good guy, you know, such a good man. And I realized that if I was going to change at Sonoma, like it had to be authentic. Like I'd honestly change who I was, not just say, grin and bear it. And I know you want to like, you know, yell at that guy. He's going to have to bite your tongue on this. Like I had to honestly believe that without these guys trusting in me, that we were not going to have any success. And I think that's also, you know, it's a great point that we can't simply say, oh, this is what you must do. And then we do, we have to believe it. And we have to do the work to transition. It's an exercise, you know, and it's a muscle and you have to train it. And I'm continuing to train it because, by the way, I fall back into those things all the time. Even to this day, I fall back into the, I'm just going to get pissed because, you know, that's still in my DNA, but, you know, I constantly am training that muscle. And I think when I went back to Sonoma, I felt grateful that I got a second chance. I was so excited to go back. And, you know, it takes a little while to understand the magic. Sometimes you don't understand the great times and the magic that you're creating until afterwards when you look back. So I had that time at Vesper that summer to look back at Sonoma and be like, what we did there was very, very special, you know? And I miss those guys and I want to let them know. And so that's why I went back. And so that second year at Sonoma was really, for me, it was just an exercise in gratitude. So if we're going to use like a word here, like I felt grateful to be on the team. But before, I thought that people should feel grateful that they were on my team. That's the difference.
Such an incredible change in heart in the way that you approach it. I'm kind of curious, you know, you go through this experience, you're rowing for Vesper, you make the top boat, you crush it there. There's a great, great story in that. And then you fall short of the Olympics. A few years later, you decide, hey, I'm going to row across the ocean and you're going to go and you're going to put together what it seems to be like some superstar team. And you're really confident going into this, but by your account, it goes really, really poorly. And I was wondering if you can kind of give a brief overview of that kind of transition to trying this, you know, Atlantic Ocean crossing, which I don't consider it a failing. You still get across the Atlantic, but I'm curious if you could kind of tell, you know, for our listeners a little bit of the story, but from the perspective of how you prepared for that Atlantic crossing and how maybe it was the other boat, I believe it was Ocean Reunion that you went up against and how they prepared for that Atlantic crossing. Like, where did you kind of start to go wrong in that preparation?
Yeah. I will say that, you know, without this first crossing that can be defined as a failure, although, like you said, we still made it across, without which it was foundational for all of my success moving forward. You know, without that and without Vesper and without Sonoma State, we don't have the world records and the success that we had. I mean, I think probably looking back, the failure started pretty early on with the recruitment process. You know, I'm coming from Vesper, so I'm thinking about building big, strong guys. I want to be the smallest guy on the team again. You know, I'm thinking that 3,000 miles of ocean rowing is just a longer version of a 2,000 meter race. You're going to push hard, you're going to rest hard, then you're going to push hard again, shovel food in your, and there's so much more. And there's 6 minutes of a race in college or an elite team is there's not a lot of time to have to deal with emotion. It's just 6 minutes. You deal with it before the race, you deal with it after the race, but you don't deal with it during the race. In a 3,000 mile journey, you're dealing with it in the middle of the race. And so just even recruiting, not being clear on what our whys were, you know, I think everybody knew that I wanted to win this race. And I think I have sometimes, I impact people in a way that they don't really want to stand up and say, well, that's not really what I want. I want to be on this team, but my motivation for being on the team is different. And I did not give people the space to be able to share that with me. And so when we got onto the, you know, the water and we're 600 miles into this race, that's when we started seeing those things kind of play themselves out. Because one of the things in these big long races is you can't hide who you are. You're going to be, you know, all of your deficiencies are going to be shown. Your strengths are as well, but you know, that's just how it's going to be. So I recruited in a way that was like, here's what we're trying to do. You're either in or you're out. Like, that's kind of it is. And people are like, oh, okay, well, I want to be in that. I want to do that. But my motivation for doing that was different. And I never heard those. I never asked them. So we go into this race having recruited, you know, three other people with four very different whys, which, by the way, is okay. You can have different whys, but we didn't try to figure out how our different whys were going to coalesce to one central thing that we were going to try to accomplish. So that was the first thing. Training in these things can be difficult. I focused a lot on the physical side, and I should have focused more on the community side. I focus on that now so much more. But being fraternal, you know, being a team, inviting other people to be part of this community, kind of building this up. So it's not just the four of us that have to do this, but it can be many, many more people that you feel are relying on you to be able to be the best version of yourself. And if you compare it to Ocean Reunion, which was a British team that, by the way, in this race ends up winning the race and beating us by, I don't know, 10 days plus, you know, they were four guys that went to boarding school together since second grade. They were best friends moving up all the way through graduation of high school in the UK. They went their separate ways, but they stayed in contact. And this was their, they called themselves Ocean Reunion because that's what it was. It was a reunion for them. They were getting back together and they loved each other. And that was apparent. And they respected each other. And that was apparent. They let each other talk without talking over each other. And that was apparent. And we were missing that. But I saw that when we were at the start line, because you're at the start line for 2 weeks, and I saw them. And I knew that that was our biggest competition. I could see the difference in our team, but I didn't think it really mattered that much. I mean, in the end, we were rowers and they really weren't. So it wasn't going to matter. And in the end, I think that was the mistake started before we pushed off.
And I'm curious, because you get it out there. One guy, Nick, gets sick, really sick. So you have to pull him off and you think you're down to three, but then Greg, I think, bails. He's like, I'm off this boat too, because he didn't feel the connection with you guys. You felt that as a leader. Like there seemed to be this failure on your part that you felt shame or guilt or responsibility. And I'm kind of curious, is that what became so much of the drive to go at this again? Because you end up finishing with your best friend or one of your best friends, Tom. And Tom's like, I'm never doing this again. But you're like, I mean, you seem like you were ready to do it again as soon as you got to shore, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we had our, you know, one of our biggest, strongest rowers, Nick, just can't get through the seasickness, is getting worse, is so dehydrated that he just can't hold in any water, any fluid. So he needs to be taken off the boat. He needs to be rescued at sea. That's not his fault. Greg says, I see an exit here, a way out, and I'm taking it. And that Greg situation is a lot, very complicated. You know, it would be easy to get down on Greg too. He did quit. I think there is a lot of him that he just didn't prepare. He wasn't prepared enough. But in the end, as the captain, leader of that team, that kind of falls on me. And so, you know, we have two people exit 600 miles into this 3,000 mile race. Tom and I finished the remaining 2,400 miles. It takes us 41 more days to do it. We don't win the race. We don't break a world record. And as I've mentioned in the doc, I think one of the things that hit me so hard was, as we were coming in on the last day of the finish, Tom is just so beside himself with excitement. You know, I mean, I think he obviously he's proud of himself. He's proud of us. He's just excited to be off the boat though. You know, I mean, he's done it now. And one of the things I told him is, throughout those 41 days when he was having his low moments, was no one will ever be able to take this away from you. Like when we're done, you'll always have it, you know, like it'll always be yours. And I think that is for him still to this day, which something that he holds on to, but I wasn't done, you know, and that's the problem, is that when we were coming in on that last day, I did feel like I was kind of acting. It was hard for me to shake this feeling of, wasn't like even like shame or guilt. It was just, I feel like I was only halfway done. And I probably couldn't have probably articulated at that moment, because so many other things are happening and you're seeing your family for the first time and you've been on the water 51 days. And so I don't think I would have been able to articulate my thoughts as saying, I'm only halfway done, I'm doing this again. But maybe in the back of my mind, I knew that this was one of two. And, you know, after getting kind of back on shore, the difference between Tom and I is he had nothing else to prove. You know, he wasn't a collegiate rower. He wasn't an elite level rower. He wasn't like a big athlete. He stayed on the boat when he could have left. And that was that's the pinnacle of his moment. And everybody on all teams have different contributions. And his contribution, as simple as it seems, was to stay so that we could finish. He just needed to not get off the rowboat onto the sailboat, and he did it. And that is an incredible accomplishment. He was scared. He was beat up. He was tired. He could have gotten off, and he chose to stay. That is an amazing, amazing accomplishment. But for me, that was a foregone conclusion. I was never getting off that boat. So that was not my goal. That was not going to be enough for me to simply get across. I wanted to win this race. I wanted to do a lot better than we did. And so within, you know, a few weeks of being home, it was becoming apparent in my head that this is happening again.
You mentioned there was something about your leadership style that did not create space for people to share their whys, to connect. You know, like, you know, you said earlier, you have a way about yourself that, you know, is very direct and forward. And I'm curious, I mean, that's, first off, let me just commend you. That's, you know, incredible self-awareness and growth. You know, I think a lot of times leaders don't learn from failures like that. They just blame the other people, right? Like, it's like, oh, we failed it here. It's because, you know, Greg couldn't hack it, or this guy, you know, is, you know, like, it's, they just want to blame the sailors, you know, not the captain. And you take this ownership, you have awareness. So I'm curious, how do you lead differently? How do you change just that, even that style, that personality style? I get it. You're going to spend a lot more time into the second row here across the Atlantic. You're going to spend more time as a team together, right? Like that, you shared that. But how do you change your leadership style?
Yeah, I think it starts with trust. You know, this idea of trust is a big part. I've worked in leadership development for a long time now, almost two decades. And I've always tried to play with these like interesting equations for, you know, the definition of leadership. Oh, it's this plus this minus this. As I've gone further along, it's become just one word. And that word is trust, is without which nothing else really matters. It's so foundational. And that trust comes from being vulnerable. It's on the surface, it's like, well, Jason has the best erg score in college, and Jason's the strongest, and Jason's the tallest. And then even when I finished this row, Jason finished the row. So on the surface, it seems like, yeah, it would be easy to point the fingers and be like, I did it. So it's obviously not me that is the problem. I'm the one who finished. But you have to start breaking down and being a little vulnerable and saying, but I could have been a better leader to Greg. I could have created space for people to be more honest with me about why they were doing this, and when they were struggling to come to me. I created none of that space. And so I started with the trust thing. And that was with this new team, just saying, here's who I am. And here's my insecurities. And here's what I want to accomplish. And here's how I want to accomplish it. But I want to hear from you as well. And when I started doing that, all of a sudden, people felt a little bit more comfortable telling me the truth. And that's the thing, is that if people don't trust you, they won't tell you the truth. Not because they think you're a liar and then they're going to be a liar. It's not that. They're afraid that you won't have their best intentions at heart if they tell you what they are, you know, and that's wrong. And that's your fault as the leader, not their fault for not telling you the truth. It's your fault. So I wanted to create space where people could tell me honestly why they wanted to do this and, you know, why they wanted to be on this team that by many accounts failed the year before. Why would you want to join this team? You know? And that is something that I think is probably the most important thing with regards to how I lead teams, is creating space for people to trust me and tell me honestly how they feel, what they're thinking, both before, during, and then even afterwards. Hey, I didn't like how we did this or how you did this. And that's a big part. And then the other part was, I think, just being able to have accountability. When I started building that other team, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, is that I realized that the team is not just the four people in the boat plus your land manager. You know, it's your family, it's your friends, it's your kids, it's your neighbors, it's actually anybody that wants to be part of it. But you know, winning a race, breaking a world record sounds really nice at the start line, but it doesn't get you to the finish. It's not proper motivation when you're in the middle of the ocean or you're in the middle of a season and you're beat up and you've got other things on your mind. It's just not enough. And I always say this, that pride will get you to a start line, you know, or the beginning of a season, but it's actually, and this word sounds bad, but it's not, shame is actually what gets you across. What I mean by that is that world records, gold medals, world championships, you know, league championships, that stuff is really easy to talk about at the beginning. But you're halfway through across an ocean, you're you know, 2,000 miles into a 3,000 mile race. That shit is not that motivating anymore. You're beat up and you want out. And the thing that will motivate you is people. It's the leveraging of human emotion. And that starts with the people in the boat or on your team, and it extends to everybody else that's been part of this. I would become more afraid of letting them down than I was of what I was about to encounter on the next 2-hour shift or the next 24 hours or the storm that was about to hit us. And that is, creating that environment takes place before you leave, before the season starts, and can be carried through. So that when your adrenaline wears off and you realize, you know what, I don't really give a shit if we get a world record, I just don't want to be here anymore, all of a sudden that kicks in and you're looking at the face of your teammate and you're seeing how beat up they are. And you're saying, they did that for me. You know, they're here for me. They're rowing their ships hard for me. I've got to do the same for them right now. That leveraging of human emotion, which is the most basic human element, is the motivator that gets us across. And that's the two things: building that trust before to allow people to tell you the truth, and then creating an environment where you can leverage each other's human emotion is so big. And I always say this, I felt it more, this will be the last thing, I'll shut up. But I felt it the most on this last row, the Pacific row I did last year from San Francisco to Hawaii. It was like, I felt the sense on race day of like, oh, thank God. All I have to do is suffer. And all I have to do is the row now. And it sounds kind of funny, but we built in so much, and I think you used this word, so much currency. We had built up so much currency in the emotional team bank. I knew we had enough to get us across. Now all I had to do is push off. As we were going through that golden gate, there was a sense of relief. Honestly, not unlike the relief I had when baseball was over. I was like, it's done. It's done. Now all I have to do is just this row. I can row. I can row beyond the waves and the elements. That's not a problem for me. It's the team.
There's such a difference in that mindset, you know, you described there. And as you keep talking, I just keep thinking about my team and the teams that I've worked with, that, you know, the ones that have done more than was expected, you know, gone beyond what people thought they would. It really has come down to this idea that we didn't have teammates that said, they owe me, I put the time in, they need to keep up with me, you know. And you alluded to this before, but it's, I owe them, right? Like they've done this for me, they've served me, they've worked for me, and now I owe them that reciprocation. And when you get to that place, I mean, it's almost like that flywheel effect, you know, that Jim Collins talks about, where we're just motivated to serve each other more. And the whole thing just is like jet fuel, you know, to push forward. And I wonder, before we get into this second Atlantic journey and kind of keep moving through your timeline, you know, one of the anecdotes that you talk a lot about is breakfast and the importance of breakfast with you and Tom on that first, you know, trip where you're struggling, you're in the grind, you know. And I think what maybe I didn't understand until I, you know, started reading the book a little bit more, was that when you guys were trying to cross the ocean as two people, it wasn't you were rowing together and then you rested together and then you rowed together. It was you were alternating shifts. So that cooperative, I mean, you could obviously see how far the other guy, you know, pushed you during that time, but you weren't really doing it at the same time together, right? And so that's different than being on yours with a partner. And so I can imagine just the grind of that, you know, and the sort of the isolation of that, even though he's still there with you. But talk a little bit just about the importance of breakfast, because I know you use that as an inflection point in a lot of the leadership training that you do. Just can you narrate that episode for us and kind of how you learned from that?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically what's going on is, you know, we've had our two people evacuated. It's been a week or so since then. We get, you know, Hurricane Alex is a hurricane that is passing through north of us, and we're on the outskirts. So we're getting hit by these massive waves. We're wet. And for 3 days of rowing, two things are happening. One is we're getting beat up. We're getting hit by waves. We're constantly saturated with salt water. You're getting salt sores everywhere. You know, you're just so beat up against the elements. And the second thing, as you alluded to, Nate, is you're out there on the deck by yourself. You're rowing 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 24 hours a day throughout the entire row, which on a four-man team, you've got at least one other person you're rowing with. But with just Tom and I, it's me on the deck of the boat while he's in the small coffin-like cabin resting, and then we switch. So it's like every 2 hours, we have like a couple minutes with each other, and that was it. And so we had this moment after kind of Hurricane Alex is kind of finally letting us go, and I'm just beat up, and I'm just, you know, to be fair, I'm like, I kind of wish I got off the boat too. And this is the first time I felt this way. And I'm at my lowest point, and, you know, Tom's kind of getting out of the cabin behind me, and he's, you know, he's getting on his stuff and like that. And, you know, and he just kind of offers up this suggestion and just says, like, you know, what do you want for breakfast? Which was kind of, if you'd known our last few days, every 2 hours, we were kind of just guy coming off shift, like I would be right there, kind of gives them the data of where what's been going on. And the guy coming on kind of just like giving some words of encouragement, empathy, whatever you want to call it. So for him to just say, like, out of the blue, like, what would you want for breakfast? Like, was a little bit jarring, to be fair. It was almost a little annoying, because I'm at my lowest point here, and he should know how that is, because that was him 2 hours before. And he's not addressing that. He's asking me some kind of seemingly insignificant question. Like, I'm gonna be like, who the hell cares what I want for breakfast? Look at where I'm at, you know? But, you know, one of the things that I just realized at the moment is, like, I am actually hungry. And 75% of your meals are freeze-dried meals, which is what he's alluding to. Like, you get a packet, it's whatever, it's flavored rice, whatever it is, and you add hot water to it. And, you know, I don't like making the breakfast. I never did. You got to get the, you know, the jet boil out. You got to get the water out. You got to try not to spill boiling water on yourself while the boat's moving around. You got to pour it in. You got to, you know, it's a lot of work, and I don't like doing it, to be fair. It was never my strongest suit. I'd rather row. But Tom's always a guy who would prefer to do those tasks, which, by the way, are just as important as rowing. But he was pretty beat up by then. He had lost a lot of weight. He wasn't a big guy to begin with. So when he asked me, like, basically offering to make me breakfast, I said, yeah, that's fine. You know, I'm like, okay. And I, you know, told him what I wanted. And so he made breakfast for both of us. You know, that was the, you know, I rode a little longer than my shift required. I rode a little bit into his shift. And, you know, he just said behind me, he says, all right, it's ready. And so, you know, I wasn't thinking about anything. I just stopped rowing because he says it's ready, and I am starving, and I just pull the oars in. And so, like, now the boat's just literally bobbing in the ocean, just doing this, you know, it's just bobbing. And so, I just turn around on my seat and we just eat. I mean, I was like, doesn't really matter at this point. We're by ourselves out here. Who, you know, no one even thinks we're going to finish. I think we can have breakfast together for a second. So we just share a meal. He gives me my meal, you know, I'm eating chicken risotto. He's having like some spaghetti bolognese, and we're just sitting there. He made coffee as well. And we're just sitting there. And it was like, again, just this moment of, this is so nice. I just get to talk to somebody, and we just share stories with each other, and we're laughing. I mean, for that moment, for that 30 minutes, we could have been at home, just talking, having a beer or something like that. It felt so comfortable. It felt familiar. you know, in a very unfamiliar, unforgiving environment as the middle of the ocean is, especially the last 3 days that we had. For a second, we had, it's like almost like we cheated, you know, we like cheated the moment. And we were able to escape for a second and pull ourselves out of this, which is, as it turns out, the most important thing I will say in that 51-day crossing was this realization that we were able to pluck ourselves out of this situation for 30 minutes and be friends and be teammates and be people that just loved each other and wanted to honestly know what happened to you the overnight. Like, tell me about that, you know? And we started rowing after those 30 minutes. And one of the biggest changes was, you know, we started going faster. And, you know, we're in 24th place out of 26 teams at this point. You know, we have a land manager that's letting us know. I mean, most people don't even think we're finishing. But we move up from that day on. And for the next 41 days, we move up from 24th place all the way up to 11th place. We passed in a little over a month all those boats. And we weren't doing anything different in terms of rowing harder or rowing longer. We still did the 2 hours on, 2 hours off. We were no less beat up. In fact, we were getting worse. But the other thing was this, the fact that we had breakfast every morning. It was 8 a.m. every morning. He'd cook. I'd row a little longer. We'd just have breakfast together. We never missed it. 41 straight breakfasts. Never missed it. I would have rather missed, you know, rowing a whole shift than that moment of breakfast. And that was, to go back to what we've been talking about earlier, was this leveraging of human emotion. It reminded us of why we were doing this. I could look him in the eye and say, God, he looks like shit. But that's because he was pulling for me and for this team. And he'd look at me and think the same thing. And I would be scared to death of letting him down for the next 24 hours. And it could be 2 a.m. the next morning. And I'd be beat up. And again, asking myself, why am I doing this? But, you know, 6 hours later at breakfast, I'd be reminded. Because, by the way, we need to be reminded of why we do things. It's not good enough for some coach to give a great rah-rah speech at the beginning of the season. That is not going to carry itself. It just won't, you know. Hell, even giving a rah-rah speech before a game might not make it to halftime. So we need to be continually reminded. And the best way to do that is to have teammates that are doing that for each other. You know, that's what Tom and I were doing for each other. And that was the catalyst for, I think, the success of my other crews.
All right, that's it for part two of our conversation with Jason. Part three is coming in our next episode of the podcast. What impressed me the most about Caldwell after the Atlantic crossing was that he didn't make excuses. He didn't blame the other guys in the boat. He chose to learn how he could be better. He practiced extreme ownership. No bad teams, just bad leaders. And that's not easy to do. How often do we blame our team's culture on a player or two, or parents around the program, or a lack of administrative support? Here's the reality. Failure is a great teacher if we are willing to learn from it. Not every leader is willing to learn from it. Jason was, and I think that's great inspiration and encouragement for us that we can take away moving forward. Thanks for listening in to today's episode. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen and subscribe to our newsletter at tocculture.com. Every week, Nick drops wisdom as well as the notes to that week's episode of the podcast.